like, you know, on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 years. What we're doing right now, we're speeding up into maybe 100 years or even decades. And so that's the reference to the fact that, you know, the whole steroids thing, and that's the reference to time, is the fact that it's not that climate change is not a normal part of this Earth's history. It's the fact that what we're doing is accelerating it. We're speeding it up much, much faster than the Earth is used to or has experienced in the past. And so that has all sorts of implications about adaptation, species adaptation, and just the ability of the planet to cope with it. We're going through one of if not the greatest extinction period in the history of the planet right now. And it doesn't seem like it because it's on our time scale, but extinction events last over, you know, 100,000 years, a million years. That's kind of like the level of extinction event that wiped out the dinosaurs. What we're going through right now is faster than that, but we don't really have a good conscious feeling for that because on our time scales, we're not really noticing it so much. But if you expand this rate out over to geologic time, it's devastating. And so that's I guess the theme that I've had for the whole week here is just that we're kind of out of sync with natural time, with geological time. And in order for us to be able to cope with the various environmental problems we have around the world, whether it's water quality issues, whether it's, you know, sustainable agriculture, whether it's, you know, climate change, whether it's species extinction, any of these kinds of things here, it's really more about us getting in sync with the environment getting in sync with us. I mean, you know, the environment will take care of itself over time if you give it enough time, but that may not be soon enough for us in a lot of ways. So that's kind of the emphasis of this week. So this is just a cartoon of the basic energy inputs and outputs on the Earth's planet. And if you take an average section of the globe here, you get about 342 watts per meter squared that are coming in from solar radiation. And a good chunk of this is actually bounced off the clouds, 77. Another chunk here is bounced off the Earth's surface. So right off the bat, we lose about 107 watts per meter squared just by reflection, bouncing off the Earth's surface. There's about 168 that are absorbed by the surface of the Earth, and about 67 that are absorbed by the atmosphere. So if we're in a perfect balance, then you can come over to the other side and look at what some of these, the outgoing,
energy.
Yeah, the outgoing energy. So there's a combination of about 40 watts per meter squared that come off of the Earth's surface. There's another 30 that are coming emitted by the clouds. There's another 165 that are emitted by the atmosphere. Then you've got evapotranspiration and thermal. So if you combine those terms together, you get 342 that are going out.
You say emitted versus reflected.
Emitted, yes. So this is something that's reflected, so the wavelength is not changed, and that's kind of a key consideration here. The wavelength is the wavelength going out is the same as the wavelength coming in. It's just bouncing. What happens here is, so these are coming in as high energy, low wavelength. So the smaller, the shorter the wavelength, the higher energy the wave. So what's coming in here is this high energy, short wavelength radiation. When you emit it from a surface, when you warm up the surface and it gives it off as a lower energy, lower or higher wavelength, longer wavelength radiation. So the energy that's coming off the surface of the Earth is different than what's coming in. It's got a different characteristics to it, and that's kind of an important consideration here. So when everything is in perfect balance here, we've got 342 going in, we've got 342 going out, and it's just like energy in your house. You know, essentially, you've got insulation in the roof of your house. You know, if the amount of energy that's leaving your house is the same as the amount of energy that you're putting in from your furnace, the temperature of your house stays constant. If you change the insulation properties, if you keep the energy of the furnace on the same setting or the same output, and you increase the insulation, your house is going to get warmer. If you decrease the insulation in your house, the house is going to get cooler. I mean, this is really not too sophisticated science here, in the sense that it's just an energy balance. And what's up in the atmosphere acts, I mean, it kind of is a reflector, but it's also kind of insulation, like in your house. And so it's not too complicated on that level, that all climate change science really is doing is trying to measure the amount of energy in, amount of energy out and see how that balance is working. Yeah.
A key issue, I think, is as we've done a better job of cleaning air pollutants, removing soot, we've actually increased the rate of climate change.
Right, right.
And it's, so for example, if the Chinese stopped polluting with all their coal burning plants, we'd be in a lot of trouble.
Right, and that's this terminology here, the reflected by clouds, aerosols, and atmospheric gases. And that's why when you have a volcano that's particularly explosive and can inject all the aerosols into the upper atmosphere, that actually acts as a coolant. And I'll show you some figures later on that kind of show you the impact, like Mount Pinatubo, and what that did to the temperature of the Earth in the year 2-3 after that happened. And you're right. And so, you know, if you look at this figure and the different inputs and outputs and where things are reflected, I mean, it gives you an idea about where folks are thinking in terms of geoengineering and ways of trying to, you know, fix things. You know, there's been suggestions that, well, we could put mirrors up in space that are constantly oriented toward the sun that reflect the sun's radiation back so that this term here, this 342, would actually drop if we put these mirrors out in space to reflect energy back. Or another suggestion is that, well, we could artificially put aerosols up into the atmosphere, sulfur compounds into the upper atmosphere, which would increase this term and reflect more back so that we don't have so much that's reaching the Earth. And so, you know, when you look at this particular, I mean, it gives you some ideas about the different possible solutions as well. What we're talking about right now, the whole issue with climate change is the fact that we've been increasing the greenhouse gases here. And so this is a reference to the fact that, let's see, I don't know if this is the back radiation here, but as you increase this amount of the greenhouse gases here, essentially this surface radiation that's coming back, you're getting more of it that's getting trapped. And I'll see if I can demonstrate.
Wait a minute, isn't that related to the coal burning, let's say, in China? Isn't that? That's not greenhouse gases then, huh?
Well, so coal burning in China does two things. It emits greenhouse gases, which would affect...
Which does trap.
Which would trap more heat. But it also emits aerosols here, which would reflect the incoming radiation. So with a lot of these things, there's a push-pull, and a lot of times it's not just, you know, when you do one thing, you don't just affect one process. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And that's one of the reasons why I think climate change has had to evolve a little bit, and why there were some complications early on. You know, the whole issue about that scientists thought we were going into a global cooling period. Back in the 70s, that was just kind of us trying to get to a better understanding of how climate change science works. You know, early on when they first predicted this effect, the greenhouse gas effect, that the atmosphere would be warming, they built models for trying to predict or hindcast what temperature should look like across the globe. And they found all these places where it wasn't, you know, they found there were places on the globe where their models were pretty good, but there were other places on the globe where their models didn't work. And it wasn't until they realized that sulfur dioxide emissions, you know, from coal burning and from other kinds of fossil fuel combustions, were putting these aerosols into the atmosphere and creating this shielding effect. And when they factored that in, then all of a sudden all these models started to make sense. And so it's just the evolution they're trying to understand. All the different factors that go into climate change science. And so we're getting better and better as we go, and our models are getting better at predicting, because we're starting to understand all the time, you know, these different pushes and pulls on the different kinds of processes that happen.
I've read that the vapor trails from airplanes are providing a shield also, and that at 9/11 they did experiments because the plane stopped, and they did measurements, and it's not insignificant what the vapor trails from airplanes shields.
I believe that, yeah. It's you know, it's a complicated system for sure. So hopefully we can get through this one here without too much confusion. So as I said, part of the issue is that the incoming radiation is coming at these short wavelengths with lots of energy. And what's coming back out, what's coming back out is coming at lower energy at longer wavelengths. And so this is just three of the greenhouse gases, methane, nitrous oxide, and carbon dioxide here. And you can see that, so that these peaks here are wavelengths at which they have their maximum absorption. Every compound has got a certain wavelength that it will absorb the best. And so methane has got a couple of these regions where it will absorb. Nitrous oxide has a couple. Carbon dioxide has a couple down here. And so the issue is that the incoming radiation is coming down in at this wavelength. And then because it's lower energy coming back out, then it's, you know, we're getting a span that's coming out at this wavelength. And so that's why the energy can come in, because it's a different wavelength, but when it goes back out, it gets trapped. That's kind of the fundamental issue here. And in some ways, you know, this ability to absorb radiation is actually a good thing here. Here's oxygen and ozone. This is what the ozone layer does for us, is that it protects us from all of this very high energy, very harmful radiation coming in. So our, you know, it's, again, it's a push-pull. The ability of these gases to absorb radiation at certain wavelengths is beneficial to life. If you let all these things in, if you strip the ozone layer off the Earth's surface, then we have serious problems here. So, you know, I don't want to characterize this as anything as being good or bad. It is. You know, in some ways it's good, and in some ways it's bad. But anyway, so that's the benefit of having all that ozone up there, is that it protects us. This is the wavelength of a lot of the energy that's coming in the visible range here. And then this is the problem here, is that we've got these greenhouse gases here that trap that longer wavelength, lower energy radiation coming back off. Yeah.
So on that scale, again, where's the visible light roughly?
You know, I should know this kind of stuff just off the hand. Off, I mean, it's literally right in this range here. It's on the order of, you know, several hundred nanometers. I don't know why I can't remember numbers like that. Anybody here remember your roids you give and what nanometers are blue and any of that?
It's fairly narrow in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Right.
Visible light is.
Yeah. I mean, so we measure UV visible absorption in our river samples there as a proxy for organic matter, and I guess we're scanning from like 250 on up to about 800, something like that. So I, you know, so it's probably somewhere in like the 300 to 400 up to 800 is the visible light. So that would put it kind of in
right where you said
this range.
Yeah.
Okay. So this would be some of the ultraviolet radiation that's coming in that we do have to wear sunscreen for, but then we're missing out on all of the stuff that's even more damaging than that. Yeah.
The other point you make, it's not good or bad. If we took all of the greenhouse gases, including water vapor, out of the atmosphere, not that we could, the Earth's temperature would be below zero on average year-round.
Right, right, yeah. It's the greenhouse gases that make this planet habitable and amenable to life here, too, yeah. So, you know, everything in moderation, I guess, is the terminology that's good for this.
What is the spectrum of the energy coming in from the sun? I mean, is it dominated by the visible light? Is it dominated by the infrared? Is there a corresponding curve that shows how much radiation we get at those different frequencies?
I'm sure there is. I just didn't go and dig this up. This is,
as I recall, it is dominated by visible light.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's fusion. So it would be related to the molecules that are being. So it would be fairly well defined, what's coming out. Yeah. Because again, you know, just in the same way that these molecules have very specific wavelengths that they absorb, when you have some sort of a chemical process that's involving, you know, something as uniform, I guess, as hydrogen, you're going to get a similar kind of wavelength or very kind of a focused band. This plot here is literally something that I threw up into this presentation about 10 minutes before I walked down here, because I was thinking about this and thinking, you know, somebody's going to ask this question. It would be a good thing to have on there. I gave this talk last week as well, too, so I, you know, I'm trying to learn from experience. So here's the plot, or this is the curve, the famous curve, that really started to put us down the path toward worrying about greenhouse gases and greenhouse effects. And this is just, there was a scientist in Mauna Loa who had started measuring CO2 on a regular basis back in 1958-ish or so. And this was at 315 right here. And this just demonstrates that there's been this steady march. And again, initially, you know, you can demonstrate that this increase is coming from fossil fuels because the carbon that's burned off by fossil fuels has some distinct differences in it from the carbon dioxide that was already in the atmosphere. For one of the things is that carbon that's burned off by fossil fuels, for instance, is considered C14 dead. There's no C14 at all in it because it's fossil. It's been in the ground for so long that all the C14 has been converted to nitrogen, I think is what it goes into. I don't know, maybe that's not right, but I think it's nitrogen. Anyway, it's gone. So what's coming out from these fossil fuels is C14 dead.
Is that an isotope of
it's
carbon?
An isotope. It's a radioactive isotope of carbon. And so you can actually measure the drop in the decrease in carbon-14 in the atmosphere because you're diluting this, you know, a carbon-14 is something that's produced naturally in the upper atmosphere because of photochemical oxidation from the sun. So it stays at a pretty constant state in the atmosphere unless you start diluting it with some C14 dead source, which is what's happening with fossil fuel. Yeah.
I realize the main message here is across time, but the variability looks like within a year is so constant that is it a seasonal thing?
Yeah, it's a seasonal thing because during the winter you don't have photosynthesis happening, and so in the summertime. In the summertime, you've got photosynthesis occurring, and so you're building up biomass during that time period, and you know that draws down the CO2. In the wintertime, it's going up. So we're a very northern hemisphere dominated. We have a northern hemisphere dominated system. If the land mass was spread evenly between the northern and the southern hemisphere, then this effect would probably be dampened quite a bit. But the fact that most of the land mass is in the northern hemisphere, and that's where you've got the terrestrial plants, that's one of the things that drives this trend here. But I also understand that this is a little bit complicated by emissions coming from China as well, that there's a seasonality of emissions. So this is the air that you get over Mauna Loa is stuff that's coming off the Asian continent. So my understanding is that's also the seasonality of the energy usage in China and Asia is one of the things.
But you think that would be getting larger over the years? But
yeah,
it's certainly more of a problem.
Yeah, right. So
have they measured it somewhere else? In along the range in other.
A longer range? No, I mean, I think that this is the longest range trend that they have. There are other places that it's being measured all the time now, but this is the longest.
But not for very long.
What's that?
But not for very long. How long? You know, 10 years, 15?
You mean in other locations?
Yes.
Or just this one?
No.
I'm not sure how long it's been going in other locations, but that kind of comes to one of the cool ways of trying to get back at these kinds of answers. So these are three of the greenhouse gas concentrations here. There's three different scales here. So carbon dioxide is in the red numbers here, and this is in parts per million, and that's on this scale here. The nitrous oxide is in black. That's also on this numerical scale, but it's a factor of 1,000 lower. So that's on parts per billion. And then the methane is on this scale here, and that's also in parts per billion. So the question is, well, how did they get these things all the way back down to the year zero? Any clues?
Yes.
Ice cores.
I'm sure, yeah. It's ice cores. So the ice cores trap bubbles of gas when they're formed. And so when the ice layers are put down there, they trap bubbles of gas for that particular time. And so what they can go back and do is take ice cores in Antarctica or in the Arctic, and they measure the amount of gas that's in those bubbles. And so this is how you can kind of reconstruct things all the way back, and this is why you don't have that sort of seasonal sawtooth pattern that you get with the actual measurements we're making right now, is because those ice core bubbles are going to be averaged over years, and you know it's a dampened signal is what you're getting here. You're not going to get a nice crisp signal for the ice cores there because these bubbles are going to be averaged out. But this kind of gives you an idea about where we're headed and where we're trending right now. The industrial age is kind of 15, 16, 17. The industrial age is commonly defined to start at 1780. That's kind of when we went into the, and, you know, really started going after fossil fuels and burning things. So You know, everything, all the action is happening pretty much from that point on. And you can see that the effect of what we've been doing with the atmosphere on any of these gases is pretty significant.
Are the measurements in recent years also from ice gas bubbles?
No, these are just direct taking samples out of the air and measuring it.
There's not a possible conflict in the data?
Conflict. Well...
Well, I would imagine that the air over Antarctica is somewhat different than it is over the Northern Hemisphere.
It takes about a year for things in the atmosphere to completely circle the globe. So one of the problems that we have with, like with mercury as a pollutant, is that, you know, we can control our mercury emissions here by putting in new legislation and fixing our coal-fired power plants and scrubbing all the mercury out, but everything that's produced in China will be over our atmosphere within a year anyway because of that mixing. So there is a little bit of a distinction. So between Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere, there's a little bit longer lag time between how long it takes for things to get transmitted between the two hemispheres. I'm not an atmospheric scientist, so I don't remember how long that lasts, but I mean, I'm pretty sure that it's under 5 years or so. So it takes, it's around the Northern Hemisphere is within a year, around the Southern Hemisphere is within a year. North and South is a little bit longer. So in terms of these ice cores here, then I'm guessing that the amount of time that the average ice bubble thing that you get there is going to be somewhere within that time span. Yeah.
I wish this question to be asking if in mostly around the 2000 on, if that's an ice core also that's being taken, or is it an atmospheric reading? And are, in other words, is it apples to apples, or is it oranges to apples?
Well, whenever they generate something like this, they're very careful to try to you know, if, I mean, they're gonna take these measurements and work pretty carefully to try to. What's the right word for it? I'm having troubles with my
calibrate.
Yeah, it calibrate, correlate.
For consistency, basically, they've figured out how to do that.
Yeah. I guess it's inner calibration, I guess inner calibration. That's not exactly the word that I'm using for, but I mean it's the same kind of principle where. I do lignin measurements in my lab. There's several other labs around the world that do lignin. Every now and then, it's handy for us to all measure the same sample and calibrate our measurement to make sure that we're reporting the exact same thing. And so that kind of stuff happens in science all the time. Reconciliation, that's the right word I'm looking for. It's if they're trying to reconcile the different ways of making measurements and trying to make sure that everything is working off the same scale. And that's an important question because some of these plots that I show you later on will be based on something called an anomaly as opposed to exact measurements, because anomalies, the difference between two values, it's easier for me to report the difference in my measurement from a standard and look at anomalies. You know, if I measure the standard and I measure my sample and I report the difference, the chances that anomaly is more accurate than my actual fixed number is pretty high, and so you get away from a lot of complications by reporting anomalies, the difference between two things. That's another way of trying to resolve differences between labs and difference between measurement techniques, is by measuring anomalies, the difference between a standard and a sample, and reporting the difference instead of the actual measurement that you made.
This data is all ice gas data?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
Several recent years.
Why? They're saying except for recent years. Is there ice at all?
I think it probably is all. I'd have to go back and take a look at it. I believe it is all ice core. And so then the key thing to take a look at would be for carbon dioxide right now on the current record. I mean that's pretty close to what we're measuring right now. That's out about 380. So and I guess that would be one of the ways to. Determine whether or not the accuracy of these cores, the accuracy of these ice core measurements, is how well they correspond to what we're actually measuring right now. And I guess the answer is they're within 5 or 10 parts per million, or parts per billion here. No, parts per million. So, you know, you can make a reasonable, I mean, I guess the point of doing that kind of comparison is just to say that these ice core measurements are giving us reasonable values. And again, the thing about the ice cores here is that, you know, it's not so much the absolute number here, it's the difference between here and here. If this is giving us real numbers, if we can at least trust the fact that these are giving us reasonable numbers here, then it's, then we look at the difference between this and, we, and then this. That's the basis for concern. That's the basis for modeling a lot of the problems that are happening right now. You got a question, Tom?
If I get an ice core, how do I know that I'm looking at something 1,000 from the year 1,000 or the year 500?
I don't remember all the techniques for dating a core, but one of the ways that you can do it is with C14 data. So there will be a very, when this gas bubble was trapped here, carbon dioxide will have a very specific C14 year, and then I should know what the half-life of carbon is. It's like 5,700 years or something on that order. And so within this 2,000 year time span, you can get very, very accurate dating from carbon 14. So you just measure the bubbles and then you can calculate back how the decay rate and how old it's supposed to be. That's one of the ways that you can do it. But isotopes, radioisotopes is the most common way of doing it. With ice cores, I'm not sure if you can actually count layers. If you've got any kind of varving, if there's a seasonal different depositional difference in there. I mean, a lot of times what will happen is that, you know, you're laying down the ice in the wintertime, and then during the summertime you end up depositing aerosols, dirt, all sorts of things on there. And so those dirt layers can actually allow you potentially to count your way back through an ice core, depending on how disturbed or not disturbed the ice was when it was getting laid down. I'm just speculating on that one, so don't quote me. I mean, it's, you know, but it's the same, but that's, it's that kind of concept. Other questions? Okay, so, you know, based on these measurements, based on ice cores, based on the different things that we've taken a look at, you know, they can now calculate. So we know, carbon dioxide acts much like an insulation. I mean, it is an insulator in those specific wavelengths. And so, you know, when you put insulation down in your attic, you get an R value on it. That R value tells you what the heat trapping capability of that insulation is. And it's physical sciences. It's very easy, and you know, you can calculate it very accurately. It's a very well-known property here. It's not voodoo science. And so you can take a look at the difference in how much CO2 has been put into the atmosphere since the industrial age, and you can make a very accurate calculation. Well, I say very accurate. I'm not exactly sure what the error is in there, but I mean, relative to the whole term there, that's a pretty decent number there. You can make a fairly accurate calculation of how much heat, extra heat, this increased carbon dioxide is going to capture as it radiates off the Earth's surface. And you can do the same thing for CH4 or for methane. You can do it for nitrous oxide. I didn't show you a plot of the halocarbons. These are things that we've emitted in the atmosphere from, you know, aerosol cans, from refrigerants, things like that. Those also have trapping effects as well, but not all of them. Some of them are actually behave as a cooling, have cooling effects. So not all the halocarbons trap energy, and so there, it's more of a mixed bag. It's a little bit more confusing, and there's a lot of them. So I didn't show you a plot of all of those. But anyway, so you can calculate the radiates of forcing, I guess is the terminology. This is the change in that energy balance that you would expect it to get. And this is, again, in watts per square meter. So that first slide I showed you was 342 watts per square meter. What this suggests is that the carbon dioxide has a change of 1.6, roughly, watts per square meter change in that radiative forcing, that the carbon dioxide alone here is going to increase the amount of energy that's trapped by 1.6 and change that balance by that much. The combination of the rest of these long-lived greenhouse gases is about 1 watt per square meter. Ozone, depending on where it is, you know, ozone is a pollutant that we get in fossil fuel burning cars emit ozone. Ozone is one of those key components of smog that you hear about. So there's a distinction between tropospheric and stratospheric. When it's in the upper atmosphere, the high atmosphere, it acts as net cooling. And when it's in the lower atmosphere, it acts as a net warming effect there. There's kind of a difference in how it behaves. And there's a distinction here between long-lived greenhouse gases. So carbon dioxide, I'll show you some plots on the back end about carbon dioxide. There's a lot of complications in how folks refer to the residence a time of carbon dioxide. I think the most realistic way to talk about it is that it's hundreds to thousands of years. It's there for a long time. It takes a long time to scrub carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Methane is about 10 years, and nitrous oxide is about 120 years. That's about how long it takes, how long it stays in the atmosphere before it comes out. Kind of another interesting point about this is that even though there's a lot less, like a factor of 1,000 less nitrous oxide in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from anthropogenic forcing, this is about 310 times greater absorber of this long wave radiation than carbon dioxide. Methane is on the order of, getting my numbers, I think it's on the order of like 21. I think that's the number I remember. So methane is about 20 times greater greenhouse gas absorber, or sorry, energy absorber than carbon dioxide is. So the reason, you know, there's a lot of folks who for a while there were talking about, well, you know, carbon dioxide is, you know, yes, it's going up and all these things are going up, but the most important greenhouse gas in the atmosphere by tons and tons is water vapor. We should be looking at water vapor content. We shouldn't be looking at CO2. The difference is that water vapor here is, the lifetime of that is about 7 days. Water up in the atmosphere has a lifetime of about 7 days, so it can't be a driver. It reacts, but it doesn't drive because it's up in the atmosphere for such a short amount of time. This surface albedo, that's that reflectivity term that I showed in that first plot, there's the energy that hits the clouds or hits the, you know, the aerosols in the upper atmosphere and bounces. There's the energy that hits the Earth's surface and bounces. That's what this albedo term is. And so you can imagine that when there's a lot of glaciers and snow in the northern hemisphere in the wintertime there, one of the reasons why it gets so cold is that you're bouncing that energy off the Earth's surface. You're hitting a white surface, it's coming straight back off. That's albedo. So there's a couple different things that come into play there. Land use change is one of the things there. You know, when you chop down a forest and you remove the trees and you expose the ground, that's a change in albedo. There's going to be different kind of reflection properties on that land use once you've changed it. Black carbon on snow. So we've been increasing the amount of burning that's sort of a reflection of the industrial age. And all of this black carbon that's deposited on the snow increases the amount of energy that's getting trapped or actually decreases the amount of energy that's going to get reflected because it acts sort of as a black body sink. Aerosols, again, this is a reflection, your comment earlier about the industrial age right now, putting all these aerosols up in the atmosphere. This is the net cooling effect that our pollution in the atmosphere has caused. Yeah.
And how long are those aerosols held in the atmosphere? What's their lifetime compared to?
Generally on the order of a few years, one to three years, something like that. I mean, you'll see that from the volcanoes. Mount Pinatubo had a direct cooling of the atmosphere, and you can see, I'll show you some of those figures here in a minute or so, and you can see how long that little band lasts before those aerosols got stripped out.
So they come out long before this
one. Yes, they do. And then there has been some changes in solar irradiance as well. There's another, another criticism of climate change science at some point was they said, well, the amount of energy that's coming off the sun is increasing, and that's really the cause of climate change. It's not anything that we're doing on land, but you can calculate that pretty accurately, what's coming off the sun. And yes, there has been a slight increase in the amount of irradiance that's coming from the sun, but it hasn't been nearly as much as what we're getting from some of the other factors. And so when you take all the net pluses and all the net minuses and add it all up, we've got a radiative forcing effect of about 1.6 watts per square meter right now. And so this is all fairly robust science here. It's not something that, I say that, and then I see some of these terms here right now, there as well. You know, it's still evolving. But we certainly have a pretty good handle on what's happening in these things, because again, these are it's one compound. We know what the properties are. We can make the calculations pretty well.
Is the bar you pointed up there at the end of the
this one?
Yes. Is that a standard error measurement?
I don't, well, statistically, I don't see how you could calculate a standard error. I would call it an uncertainty. And uncertainties are calculated in different ways than standard errors.
Well, the reason I ask is because the one down on the total is certainly a lot different from what you would expect based upon.
Yeah, and I would imagine that, you know, and then there's other, you know, trying to sum all of these uncertainties up here. I mean, I would imagine that this range right here is driven a large part by these two effects here. I mean, that there's such a, there's a larger uncertainty on those, and so generally you sum uncertainties, or, you know, you have, it's roughly speaking, there's a way of summing these uncertainties, and so it's the largest uncertainty is the one that's probably going to dominate your final answer, or your, you know, your final calculation.
And that also drives the dispute between scientists in terms of how quickly the process is going to continue. Mm-hmm. You know, is it, there are skeptics that think it's not all that bad and they would be on the other end of the arrow.
Yeah, they would be focusing on this number.
Right.
Whereas there's a lot of folks who are focusing on that number too.
Right.
Right, and so, you know, you do these kind of calculations to try to measure this effect here, but, you know, when push comes to shove, then it's also worth just looking at the actual data and deciding what's going on, or looking at what's going on. So again, I talked about, I mean, that concept of measuring anomalies instead of an absolute temperature here. So this is a plot that shows net forcing, which is the blue term here, or the blue line, versus the global temperature. And this global temperature is something that's derived from several, I guess, thermometers around the globe, that measurements around the globe, and they just, again, they measure the difference from one year to the next. The reference point, I forget where the reference point for this particular figure is, but I think they chose some range, some here, like an average value from some range in here, as the zero point. And so they basically take that reference point, and then they subtract, then when they make a calculation of the net forcing in 1880, they subtract this value from that value, and that's where the anomaly comes from. Or the same thing with the temperature. So that's the concept of anomalies. And, you know, what you can see here is that the net forcing, as it's going up, our temperature has been also going up. This is the effect of Mount Pinatubo. So that blew, I guess, in 1990-91, somewhere in that area. You know, it took us about 3 years, 3 to 4 years, to sort of rebound from that before it all got scrubbed out of the atmosphere, and we continued our march upward. I forget what this volcano, I mean, these three are all volcanoes, and those are what drove the forcing down, and you can see that there, at least in these two cases, there were a corresponding decrease in the temperature as well. So, you know, you're looking for some kind of evidence to see whether or not your net forcing makes sense with what we're seeing in the temperatures. And so that's kind of what this plot is intended, just, you know, give you an idea about how well our the calculations of net forcing match up with what's happening with the temperature.
It matches quite well from 1960 on, mm-hmm. but there's that period from 1910 to 1940 where the temperature seems to be changing.
Right.
But the net forcing is relatively constant.
Right. And I guess the best way to answer that is the fact that anthropogenic effects are not the only thing that drive climate, that there is natural variation that happens all the time as well. And so even if the net forcing stays the same, you know, there's still just going to be things that happen in terms of that natural variation. And so that's another one of those things that kind of gets a little bit confusing at times, is trying to distinguish between, you know, how confident can we be that this increase right now is related to human effects as opposed to just natural variation. That's one of the counter-arguments to the whole issue of climate change.
Is there some issue here, too, because it starts out at 1880?
The 1880
measurement issues is what I was trying to get at.
You know, I don't remember exactly the reason why it started the 1880, but I would imagine it has to do with where you're actually being making measurements, or the reliability of the temperature measurements, not reliability, when folks actually started making temperature measurements, enough of them on a regular basis that you could work with that data. That would be my guess, but I don't remember specifically why this plot starts only at 1880. Yeah.
Where did they come up with the temperature measurements? You know, placing. If they measure in the Pacific Northwest this year,
right.
They'd be way off. You know.
Well, if they measure in the Midwest, they'd be way off too.
I know, right.
You know, so it works both ways. So back here where they're not really thinking about. I mean, the climate change science really kind of started here in probably the 60s, 70s, somewhere in there. So at that point, you can start putting out thermometers in the most, in the weather stations in the most strategic places to try to be able to get at, get at this kind of stuff. Prior to that, you're just looking at places of opportunity, just any measurements that exist, and you try to go through there and you evaluate the biases that you might have on any particular thermometer, and you just do the best you can with the data that was available. And so, you know, that might be another answer to the question about why there's more of a discrepancy. There seems to be more of a discrepancy between the values here and here than there is here. It's because here we started paying attention and we started making the measurements that would allow us to do this more accurately. This shows you again, I don't remember exactly what the proxy was for calculating this temperature difference. This just kind of puts it on a longer time scale. And you can see that the temperatures that we've got right now are greater than anything that we've had in the last 2,000 years. That's kind of another indicator that there's something different going on right now than there was in the past. I mean, we definitely had periods where the temperature is going up and down over in the years past, but what's going on right now is different than anything in the last couple thousand years. This is another plot. It's got the global mean temperature since back. What is this one? This one here starts at 1850-ish or so. And this plot here kind of shows you that there seems to be a trend that things are. And this is one of the things that's concerning folks is the fact that it seems like things are ramping up right now. So if you take the slope across the entire span, you've got a rate of about 0.045 degrees centigrade per decade. If you shorten it to a little bit less here, that increases to 0.074. If you take a smaller slice here, it's at 0.128. And if you take an even smaller slice here, it's at 1.77. And so this is kind of a plot that concerns a lot of folks because it looks like things are accelerating right now, that things are starting to, that this is not a linear trend where, you know, we put in a certain amount of carbon dioxide, we get a certain effect in the temperature here, there seems to be a nonlinear effect in this, and that as we get higher and higher on these temperatures, there's feedback systems that are starting to kick in, and we're actually starting to accelerate the process. That's another thing that concerns a lot of folks right now. Yeah?
We're talking about the tundra's melting and releasing carbon dioxide that was stored in the ground.
Right, we're when we lose all those, the ice layers in the north, you know, we lose the ice, we lose a lot of that albedo. That's a negative feedback where, you know, you lose, when you melt all the ice, then you start to accelerate the warming effect. When you warm up the Arctic and you release all that carbon that's been buried for however long in the peats, you know, we've got a lot of carbon that's buried in the peat soils. When you melt off all the snow and you warm that up, that carbon gets released. If it gets released up into the atmosphere, then you start to accelerate the trend. And so there's a lot of these negative feedbacks that are happening right now that lead scientists to believe that this trend is going to accelerate, not be a linear thing. And so that's another one of those reasons that why there's some cause for concern. So one of the efforts folks have been doing is trying to generate computer models in order to try to predict this. I mean, a lot of what we're trying to do right now is to take the data that we have right now, use computer models to predict what's going to happen into the future. And so this is a plot that's kind of that's intended to demonstrate how well the modeling efforts are going right now, at least in predicting or hindcasting what's happened in the last 2,000 years so that you can have some confidence or not in their ability to predict what's going to happen in the future. So all these yellow squiggles here are 14 different models that were used to generate the predicted temperatures or hindcast temperature anomalies. over the past 100 years. This red line here is the average of all 14 of those models. And then this black line here are the actual temperatures. And so, you know, you can see that the models that they've generated, that they've got right now, are starting to do a pretty good job of predicting or hindcasting the effects in these temperatures here. And so, you know, having some confidence in your models to be able to predict or to hindcast what happened in the past is also very important for allowing you to believe what's going to happen in the future. So, based on these models, that kind of gives you an idea about how well they're going to be able to do about predicting what's the kind of climate change, the kind of temperature change that we're going to have in the future. So this is some more indications of changing climate change. This is changes in soil moisture over the last 100 years. And again, that's, as I mentioned, that's a proxy for changing precipitation. If your soil is getting drier, it's because you probably haven't been getting as much precipitation. If it's getting wetter, it's because you've been getting more. And so blue are regions where you've been getting more precipitation. You know, this might have a pretty good reason why we've been having troubles in the Midwest with flooding lately, is because we're getting more precipitation there. So, you know, calculating 100-year floods based on old data probably doesn't mean quite so much when you've got more precipitation happening right now. Yeah?
What are the numbers on the scale?
You know, I was trying to figure that out. This stands for some kind of an index, and I'm not sure what it means. But this is soil moisture, so it's not, I don't know how you would directly convert that into precipitation. But, you know, it shows you different things about why the Sahara Desert has been getting drier. It shows you a little bit, gives you an indication about why there have been more droughts in the West Coast over in the last few decades, just because there's a changing pattern in precipitation. This shows you ice and snow meltage that's been occurring over the last, I guess, 50 years. This is the air temperature, surface air temperature anomaly north of 65 degrees. And it's been going up. It's gone up by over a degree, I guess this is degrees centigrade, so like a couple degrees Fahrenheit, it's gone up. This is the anomaly of sea ice. So there's been a decrease in the sea ice extent from season to season, or from year to year, and you can see that that's decreasing. This one shows the anomaly of frozen ground extent. So this is the amount of permafrost that you have north of 65 degrees, and that's been shrinking. That gives you an idea about how, what is it, extent 10 to the 6 kilometers squared here, so we've lost about 1.5 times 10 to the 6 kilometers squared of frozen ground in the last 50 years. And then this one shows you the anomaly of snow cover extent, so this is probably going to be more of a seasonal type effect there than the winter snows, and that's also been decreasing. This again is in 10 to the 6 kilometers squared. That one looks like it's dropped by about 2 times 10 to the 6 kilometers squared. And glacier mass balance, the amount of ice that's stored in glaciers has been dropping in the northern hemisphere as well. We've got glacial mass wastage that's happening right now as these glaciers melt away. Southern hemisphere, that's the sea ice extent. That's the surface air temperature. So you can see in the southern hemisphere it hasn't been quite so dramatic. And again, that's just a reflection of the fact that in the southern hemisphere it's mostly water. In the northern hemisphere, you've got a lot more land. And so that discrepancy between the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere is mostly the effect of just where the land is on the planet. So based on these different models, these are the modeled precipitation changes that are expected to happen because of climate change. And so the blue and the green are higher precipitation. The pink and yellow are lower precipitation. And this refers to kind of the December, January, February, that's the winter months for us, the summer months for down south. This is June, July, and August. And so what's predicted by these models is, for instance, is that there will be a lot more precipitation in the north, like in the Midwest, a lot, but on the northern part of the United States, for instance, during the winter months. But during the summer months, there's likely to be less, although it's not a huge difference in the United States there. I mean, there's some regions of the world, again, like Africa, where and the southern part of Africa, where it's predicted to be a lot worse than it is in the U.S. So that kind of gives you an idea about what's coming as far as precipitation. And then sea level change. is another one of these catastrophic effects that could potentially happen from climate change as we start to warm the surface of the water, the warming, there you get thermal expansion. There's a lot of water in the ocean, so as you expand the ocean by increasing its temperature, the sea level is going to go up. This difference right here of about 100 millimeters there, that's on the order of 4 inches. A change in 4 inches, 500 millimeters here, that's going to be on the order of, I guess, about 20 inches of change. So that's what the prediction that's in the IPCC says, that we might get up to about 20 inches of sea level rise here in the next 100 years. There are other projections that I've seen that are predicting that this could be much higher, depending on how rapidly the ice is melted, how much glacial mass wastage we have, that if there's catastrophic loss of the ice in the northern hemisphere or on Antarctica, that increase of water could push sea level change by a meter and a half, which would be on the order of 5 feet, something like that too. So, you know, when you think about the amount of the population in the world that's living near the sea and near sea level here, that would be a catastrophic kind of event, that we would have to have this mass exodus, relocation of folks out of these coastal areas here because of sea level change. So there's several different kinds of effects coming from this climate change, and I haven't even mentioned the whole issue of ocean acidification. Even aside from whether you put confidence in the climate change models to predict what's happening right now, we are putting CO2 into the world's oceans, and that simple acid-based chemistry, the pH of the ocean has risen by about, or decreased by about 0.1 unit right now, and just the ocean acidification all on its own is a global math, a global tragedy, and a global that's just changing the ocean ecosystems. And so even apart from the climate change and apart from the sea level change, the fact that we're acidifying the ocean is a catastrophe right now. And it doesn't receive a lot of attention for whatever reason. And I don't really understand why that's not more the poster child for fossil fuel burning, because there is no controversy about that. It's just simple acid-based chemistry. I mean, it's as simple as the bite you feel on your tongue when you drink a carbonated beverage. That's essentially what's happening. That's all from carbon dioxide put into water. It's the same kind of effect that we're having on the ocean right now. We're putting carbon dioxide into the water, and you can again measure how much we're putting in there, and you can measure the change in acidity, and it's real, and it's a catastrophe. So there's really three kinds of catastrophes going on right now from fossil fuel. One is the climate change effects, changes in the climate that we're going to have to deal with. One is the sea level change that's happening, and then the third one is this ocean acidification effects. And any one of those is a handful, and we've got three going on all at the same time. Yeah.
Does the sea level change, has it affected already, or will it, the Great Lakes?
The Great Lakes are at, like, what, 1,500 feet elevation?
St. Lawrence Seaway.
700 to 800, I think, is the highest elevation.
800? Okay.
Something like that. Lake Michigan is the highest elevation.
Okay.
They're connected to the Atlantic.
They are connected, through the St. Lawrence Seaway, but probably not so much. I mean, I think you'd have to go up quite a ways to affect those. You have a question?
Well, I just have a comment that in addition to those three results, just the fact of burning carbon or burning fossil fuels at the rate we are opens big questions about how we plan to continue.
Oh, you mean once it runs out?
Yeah.
That
would be wild. Yes.
Yeah, there was something about dilution of the salt content.
Uh-huh.
With the increased fresh water coming off the glaciers, that could have an effect on the heat pump. You know, there was even a goofy movie about that.
Right.
The day after.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I haven't noticed that. Yep.
Do you think they don't publicize it as much because maybe there isn't as much history?
Well, I think the main reason is that you know, most of us are not that in touch with what happens in the ocean. It's sort of out of sight, out of mind. It's the same reason why, you know, in my research field, the rivers in the tropics are so critical. They're huge, and it's like 2/3 of the riverine input into the ocean is coming from tropical rivers. well, I have to scratch and claw to get any kind of funding out of NSF because, you know, the United States doesn't have that much in the way of tropical rivers. So it's kind of an out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, where it just doesn't get enough publicity and people don't care about it. So, I mean, newspaper media is driven by what people care about. So they would have to make us care about it first before we would start buying the papers.
So what are the effects of the acidification?
So there's a lot of these organisms out there, forams, coccolis, that they build tests, calcareous tests, calcium carbonate tests around themselves. That's just that's how they work. And so when you increase the acidity of the ocean or decrease the pH, it makes it harder and harder for them to be able to form those tests because it just makes the ocean more acidic and more likely to dissolve them. So that's one of the effects that you have. Coral reefs works off of carbon or calcium carbonate, so coral reefs will dissolve. Coral reefs tend to be very highly productive areas with high biodiversity, and so the ocean acidification is basically going to wipe out all the coral reefs over time. We've got coral bleaching happening right now as these coral reefs die off, as the organisms are not able to survive anymore. So those are a couple of the effects.
Melting of permafrost, where does that go, is it become evaporation or does it drain into oceans or?
That's a subject of research. So you melt the permafrost. If you drain them, then they get oxygenated, and so it's possible that they can be respired and some CO2 can go directly up in the atmosphere. A lot of it's going to run off in rivers and it'll end up in the ocean. Some of that will get respired when it's in the ocean. It'll go up into the atmosphere. Some of it will get trapped down into the deep part of the ocean, and so that won't come back around for 500 to 1,000 years. I mean, eventually it'll get up into the atmosphere, but it might take a while.
Can you trace that water?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, I've worked on a couple of projects that do that kind of thing to try to calculate about how much of the carbon that's coming into the ocean is ending up in deep water. Maybe 20%, something like that, I guess is the calculations that I've made. Yeah.
Changing the subject a little bit, I don't know if that goes for us or not. But.
It's probably lunch here, and if you need to go, you can go here. I've got a couple more plots that I'd like to show here eventually, but go ahead.
Well, as you do that, I had the same question that we had at the beginning here. I appreciate the scientific overview, and that's mm-hmm. helpful. The thing that caught my eye in the description was the time element.
Uh-huh.
Could you rephrase or say again somewhere again where that fits in with all this for you? I understand what you're saying, since it's a compressed issue, but that's the interesting part. That's part of the question.
The time element is the fact that climate change is normal, and you can see that from things like this, that we have temperatures that go up and down all the time. So climate change is normal. There always will be climate change. There will always be, things will vary with time just because of natural conditions. There's something called the Milankovitch cycle, which is what drives ice ages and interglacial periods. So the climate change happens all the time, but what's different right now is that we're accelerating the rate. We're speeding it up. We're having an anomalous effect on climate change due to human activities. And so that's part of the time element, is that the rate is much faster now than what would happen with natural processes. So we've speeded up the rate, which has got the element of time. The other aspect of time that's important here that I think we have to deal with is how long it will take for the Earth to rebound from the increase in carbon dioxide. So this is a compressed time scale here, 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 years. If we proceed to burn through all of our fossil fuel reserves that we have right now, that'll push the CO2 in the atmosphere up over 1,400 parts per million. Right now we're at about 380, 390, somewhere in there. This is a projection of how long it would take for the CO2 to start to decrease. So over the first 300 years, you would drop, you would pull out around 60, 70% of it would go into the ocean and acidify it further. Basically, you'd be throwing away the ocean because you would be changing the chemistry so much. But you'd get rid of a lot of the CO2 in the atmosphere. Then the next long-term sink for CO2 is to react with calcium carbonate that's deposited on the floor of the ocean surface. That's got a lot longer reaction time, partly because it takes a lot longer time for this air that goes into the ocean to get down to depths and interact with the calcium carbonate that's down there. So over time, over the next 15 to 20,000 years, it'll start to decrease some of that, pull some of that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere as it reacts with the calcium carbonate in the ocean. And then the longer term sink for carbon, calcium, or for carbon dioxide in the ocean is reaction with rocks and weathering reactions that take a lot longer. But you can see that, and even in this circumstance here, you know, over the next 300 years, we're still going to be up over 600, which is quite a bit higher than where we are right now. And the projection for temperature on, changes on that would be on the order of like 2 to 4 degrees C, I believe. And, you know, so basically what we're doing is we're essentially resetting the baseline for thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. And so even if we were able to shut things down right now, things have changed forever, I guess is sort of the message. Here's another particular plot that kind of goes a little bit more conservative look at how things would go. Let's say that we were able to, you know, that we turn things around, our PCO2 in the, or our CO2 in the atmosphere gets up to 850, and we've completely converted away from CO2 from fossil fuels. At that point, this kind of shows you a decay of how of dropping this atmospheric CO2 down. And again, the point of this particular plot here is that even if we're able to shut it off, you know, we're looking at 1,000 years here up to the year 3000, but our baseline is still somewhere around 600. So I guess that's one of the reasons why there's so much concern about this issue, is that even if we shut everything off right now, it takes thousands of years to undo the effects that have happened right now. And that's the other element of time. Not so there's the rate element at the beginning, and then there's the lag time, or how long it will take for the planet to be able to recover from this on the other side. And I mean, you know, 1,000 years out, I can't even hardly comprehend that, you know, because I'm used to, I mean, I'm still in shock about things changing within my lifetime of 46 years, let alone what's going to happen 1,000 years out. Yeah.
So we're moving out of an ice age, and it would have been nice if we were moving into one so we could stick around longer to have things where they are.
Right. I mean, you know, we are supposed to be moving into an ice age over the next 10,000 years or so, but, you know, based on the projections with the CO2 in the atmosphere, they're guessing that it may be, you know, a million years before we get to the next one, just because of the amount, because of the, how drastically we're changing the Earth's temperature right now, that it'll take that long to scrub the CO2 out of the atmosphere before the planet gets back onto those Milankovitch cycles of glacial and interglacial periods.
And your point was the Earth can adapt to that, but human species probably cannot.
Well, we might. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to go that far away, because it's, you know, we managed to, you know, that's part of our human nature, is to adapt. But I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But clearly,
at least that's the concern.
Clearly, the thing is that, you know, we're no longer, I mean, it doesn't seem like we're at a place right now, at least technologically, we're not at a place right now where we're going to be able to go back to where we were. We're in the kind of area where we're changing things forever, and adaptation would be the where we have to focus right now. There may be some sort of technological fixes. I mean, the point, I guess, to take home from this plot here is that just stopping our use of fossil fuels is not going to reverse anything, because it takes too long. If we really want to be able to, you know, get back to where we were, the kind of technological fix that we would need is to actually pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and sequester it somewhere. And so that's where you get into the whole issues about, you know, burying biochar. I mean, biochar is something that lasts a long time, so if you can create char and you can bury it somewhere, that might pull some CO2 out of the atmosphere. There's been suggestions about taking CO2, liquefying it, and injecting it into geologic formations way down deep, and pulling some out that way. There's been other folks who have talked about trying to fertilize the ocean in order to draw CO2 out of the atmosphere and drop it down to the sediments and bury it. That one is kind of pretty iffy, at least right now. You know, so there's different ways, but if there's going to be a technological solution to it, it's not probably enough just to shut off our fossil fuel usage. We'll have to come up with some way of scrubbing CO2 out of the atmosphere as well. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I guess if you want to look at reasons for hope for the future, as, you know, we are pretty clever people when we're focused. I mean, mean, human species are very clever. I don't know. I don't know that we can count on a technological fix, but, you know, it's possible that it could happen. But, you know, there will probably be a multitude of potential solutions. I don't think there will be any one way of getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, but that will be what we would have to focus on. Other questions or comments? I mean, I guess if you want to look for one more reason for hope, I feel like this is such a, you know, this is not a pretty picture. It's not a pretty talk. And I apologize for doing it here at Holden, but you know, but it's the reality. You know, we can't just bury our head in the sands about it either. You know, it's there. It's real. We have to deal with it. But, you know, one of the reasons you could maybe grasp that for hope is the fact that, you know, we have the ozone hole issues and the chlorofluorocarbon issues. I mean, that was a global catastrophe in the making when that happened. And it was actually the United States that took the lead on that. The United States was the one who rammed home the treaties and rammed home the global cooperation to reduce chlorofluorocarbon emissions that have that ozone hole reversing, that we've managed to solve that problem. And so in that sense, if the U.S. would ever step up and take the lead on this, who knows what could happen? You know, we certainly have the capability to have a huge impact on what happens, so that maybe we can be closer to this one than to this one. But it definitely would take some leadership from the United States to make that happen. And so far, that hasn't been there, that political will. And it's kind of a strange thing to me, too, about why the U.S., you know, what the difference is. I don't understand the difference between the ozone hole so much and this issue.
Oh, it's easy.
Well, it's the fossil fuel thing, but...
Yeah, but it's... Chlorofluorocarbons, it was an important industry, but
right.
Pretty tiny compared
yeah.
to fuel powering your economy, and this fear that China is getting ahead of us, they are ahead of us.
Right.
You know, we don't want to do anything that'll limit our economic development strength.
Yeah.
In favor of the Chinese continued march towards global dominance.
But there's just an interesting dichotomy here too, because it's like, you know, the military is extremely worried about climate change. That's higher on their list than terrorism. I mean, and almost nuclear threat right now. I mean, in the sense that as climate change happens and resources get redistributed and that there's fights over resources. I mean, they're more worried about the impact of climate change and how that will accelerate global conflict and potentially into some sort of a nuclear exchange. That's higher on their list than terrorism right now. So the military is planning for climate change and they don't like what they see. And so you've got a conservative part of the political spectrum there that on the one hand they're ignoring the military's biggest concern while, you know, kowtowing to the energy concerns here. I mean, it's just very interesting dynamic. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of folks who've had a lot of fun studying the ethics of this and the politics of this and human behavior, human attitudes toward it, but there's, I don't know, it's such a strange issue that there's so many different kinds of conflicts, internal conflicts going on with why we can't come to grips with it and deal. You got a comment?
Well, let me provide. It's just, I think that almost works against us that, you know, being able to fix it, reverse it, we sort of have this assumption that we'll eventually, you know, all these things, somebody in some lab will fix them. But also, I think we also, even lay people, had kind of got a grip on what the ozone issue was. We understood
mm-hmm.
that this has so many ramifications and so many interactions and stuff. I think most of us kind of are, you know, we don't even know where to begin in trying to
right.
address
right.
Congress or having a public voice. Or
right.
Every person looks at us as it's more, let's forget it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a, you know, when you look at this time scale, I mean, I know it's not going to get fixed in my lifetime, too. And so then all of a sudden, you've got to put a lot of faith and trust in the next generations to, or not, you just let it go. But you know, you had a comment?
Yeah, someone said that part of the confusion about getting a handle on climate change has also been some choices that government agencies made about what was said.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one example too is, you know, I'm kind of I kind of get a little bit annoyed that the terminology early on was global warming. That was, I mean, climate change is much, much better terminology because it is, I mean, on average, it's global warming. But the effects of climate change are very localized, very regional. And so there are actually some parts of the planet that will experience cooling under the scenarios of climate change. And so climate change, I think the concept of global warming has really kind of thrown things backward a little bit too. You know, anytime you get a blizzard in the Midwest in the middle of winter, it's like, well, ha, 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 so much for global warming.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, it's more complicated than that. So I use the term climate change just because it's a little bit easier to explain things under the context of climate change than global warming. Yeah.
I have many.
It's like 5 after 12. I'll just point that out. So if you want to go, you need to go. Please feel free.
I have many Christian friends who think the global warming, climate change is a myth created by some body that's trying to make us, I don't know what. Do you know why? Have you heard any of that?
Oh, why it's a myth?
Why they think it is? And why the Christians who ought to be taking care of the planet?
Well, man should have dominion and
do
pretty much whatever they want, right?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I don't understand it. I mean, because there's such an irrationality to it that I don't know. I can't tell you. I mean, I can't explain irrationality, so I don't really understand it.
I don't think you'd call it a myth. I would think it's the controversy over, you know, what some scientists say.
Right.
You know, it's back and forth. I mean, we.
Well, what's interesting is that there's greater consensus on this issue among scientists than almost any environmental issue on the planet right now. And you know, so the folks who want to speak out against it, they pull up their kind of mouthpieces. Well, I've gone and looked at the publication records of various scientists that they're trumpeting out there as, you know, opponents of this whole climate change thing. They are not very good scientists. They do not publish stuff that gets cited. They're just, you know, they're fringe, and so, you know, that it's, but somehow they've gotten a voice because there are so many, there's a political agenda or a social agenda or a cultural agenda against this that, you know, they've kind of elevated these folks. They couldn't cut it in the real sciences, but they've got some sort of a voice and they've got some sort of credibility because they've got an appointment at a university somewhere too, but, you know, but they are not the top-notch scientists by any stretch of the imagination, and so it's kind of an interesting. Yeah, it's an interesting thing.
And I think the issue here is even if you don't believe you have a problem,
mm-hmm.
God tells us to take care of the earth.
Right.
So why not? You know,
yeah.
Limit the amount of gas
well,
you use, and why not recycle and all that kind of thing.
I mean that's like when I think about climate change and the whole issue here, that's why I always start with we can measure this is real, there's no way to that can't be controversial unless you're just completely irrational. That can't be controversial. I mean, we can measure the impacts that we're having, these are real impacts, we're increasing insulation, you know, you can convert that just by simple physics and chemistry into effects like this. And so I try to start with the most basic non-controversial stuff about climate change and then kind of build from there. And you know, at some point there are some people who are going to fall away from it and say, you know, well, you know, I'm with you up to here, you know, maybe I'm not so far with you here, you know, maybe, you know. So it's like I try to start with the pieces that are the least controversial and then work my way on down. And I think that's kind of the way that you have to approach folks who are skeptics.
The other interesting thing is the predictions made, you know, 30 years ago where there was a certain amount of uncertainty.
Yeah.
Like reduction in sea ice was predicted possibly, but they weren't 100%, maybe 99%.
Right.
Now are reality. So the things that they said, you know, 2/3 chance of happening are now happening. So
right.
The modeling is getting better, and the old modeling is actually matching predictions.
Right, so credibility is increasing, yeah.
The stuck point for me,
sure.
And the takeaway for me, is that I want to handle this through stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's saying, don't burn CO2, don't be certain. And so with the fluorocarbons, we stopped using fluorocarbons and the earth healed herself. Right?
Right.
With this issue, you're saying we could stop today and the time span issue is such, so the solution has got to be the same technology that got us in the sink in the first place. I mean, that's the thing that's...
Right, yeah, it's not good enough just to stop. Somehow we have to reverse the trend.
The trend is we're not smart with technology soon enough to mm-hmm. have the historical trend, and the solution to this is more technology. And I'm not pinging you for this. It's just the struggle in my soul is I got to get over the drive an electric car thing and into... You're going to have to put sulfide into the atmosphere to bounce off.
Yeah.
You're going to have to make a bigger mess of this ecological system to try to solve this problem.
I have a hard time believing that one will happen, but, you know.
Well, I don't know that it'll happen, but what you're saying is
right.
We're going to have to intervene further in the natural systems
yes.
to try to correct it artificially.
Yes.
We're going to have to dump something in the ocean to undo the acidification. And
yes.
That just turns my stomach, but that's basically the kind yeah. of solution we're having.
Well, the ocean acidification is pretty much a done deal.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already sacrificed
so
that. It's done.
You dump in some acidic stuff or alkaline stuff. I mean, that's what you have to do. It's kind of
called. Do you think we could get our military switched over from going to war to doing climate technology?
You know, I mean, that would be, you know, if that's what they're concerned about, that would, you know, it would be an interesting thing. If we could get ourselves out of the Middle East, maybe they could refocus.
Well, I think war creates
like
quite a bit of...
What's that?
War creates a lot of atmosphere.
Yeah. And yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it definitely relies on fossil fuels just like everything else, so, yeah. Anyway.
Thank you.
Really?
Here's a silly question. We got all these Doug firs outside the window. How much carbon is captured in a tree in its 50-year lifetime?
Well, in a single tree?
And roughly. I mean, what do we... Or pick some... What's...
Well,
I'm trying to get a sense of what the forest does.
So the average primary production on land in 1 year is about 50 petagrams of carbon per year. That's how much is fixed. And the amount that we're putting up in the atmosphere for fossil fuels, petagrams 10 to the 15,
okay.
I believe, is 10 to the 15. And the amount that we're putting in from CO2 emissions is about 3.5. So, you know, it's like about 15 times more carbon that's getting fixed. And so, you know, if you could figure out a very clever way to, you know, unfortunately about, you know, 50 petagrams is also respired off the terrestrial thing every year. And so right now, it's in reasonable balance. If you could figure out a way to sock aside 5% of that or something like that. Charlotte, I don't want you to carry my computer, okay? If you could figure out a way to, you know, 1 or 2 petagrams of that primary production and sequester it away somewhere, I mean, you know, then you're on to some kind of a solution.
Yeah. And then the tree dies.
And then the tree dies, and as it decomposes, the CO2 gets respired back up in the atmosphere.
Oh, that's the respiration that you're...
Yeah, the respiration. Yeah, as the bacteria work on it, work on it, it just gets, you know... I mean, with a tree, of course, there's a longer time span there. It doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes decades and decades to go, but you know, eventually it gets back up
into
the atmosphere. Yeah.
So what do you... If fusion were to become reality through some magic...
Uh-huh.
What impact would that have?
Fusion?
Presumably we'd be able to get rid of coal-burning
right.
power plants and we would stop our